So, today we continue our series on women of the Bible. And our biblical woman of the day is Esther. She is a Jewish shero whose story takes up an entire book in the Hebrew Bible. It's a legendary tale with twists and turns, intrigue and suspense, espionage and deceit, love and lust, and a young captive maiden who becomes queen of the Persian Empire. Now, the book of Esther is unique in that it is one of two books in the Bible that never mentions God, not one word directly about God. The other one, in case you're interested, is the Song of Solomon. So, as Kenneth Davis writes in his book, Don't Know Much About the Bible, God sits this one out. Not only is God a no-show, but the book contains few typical elements of the other Hebrew biblical books. No laws, no begats, no births, miracles, prayers, and no mention of Jerusalem. So, in fact, this book of Esther doesn't even win acceptance into the regular canon until the 4th century AD because it wasn't considered religious enough. We'll see, okay? But most current Bible scholars believe that Esther's story is not historical, it wasn't factual, but was inspired by a Persian court tale. It was probably written by a Jew familiar with the royal Persian court for those Jews who remained in the area after the Babylonian exile. Just a little history lesson here thrown in that Babylonia was conquered by Persia in 539 BCE. And this story is set in the days when the Persian Empire was the largest in history, containing 50,000 people and stretching out from modern-day Libya and Africa all the way to Pakistan. So it was huge. Now, our saga begins with a detailed description of an enormous party conducted by King Xerxes. Last week, remember we talked about the wedding celebration in Cana, and we thought that lasted a long time? Wait till you hear this. This party lasted 180 days, followed by a 7-day feast. I told you, they know how to party in those days. So as the story continues, King Xerxes, merry with wine, are we surprised after all those days? Merry with wine, commands his 7 eunuchs to bring Queen Vashti, which is queen of the time, wearing her royal crown to the banquet so that all the men from the banquet could behold her beauty. Well, many interpret this to mean she's wearing only her royal crown, or she's supposed to wear only her royal crown. So not surprisingly, Vashti refuses to come. And the king, on the advice of his ministers, divorces her and banishes her from the kingdom. Then he issues a decree declaring the husband should be the ruler in every household. All right, women, we're allowed to boo on that. It's okay. All right, so we'll go on. But after the king recovers from all the festivities, and I'm sure it took a while, he begins to miss the beautiful Vashti. So the ministers this time advise him to have commissioners from all the 127 provinces of Persia to bring the most beautiful young virgins in the land to the palace in Susa. There they will be taken one by one to spend the night with the king to see which girl wins his favor. Now that sounded like a really good idea to the king, so he issued an edict to that effect. All right, so enter Esther. She's a beautiful young orphan being raised by her uncle Mordecai, one of the leaders of the Jewish exiles. And when the commissioners come to take her to the palace, Mordecai insightfully advises her not to mention her Jewish heritage, and also he secretly follows her to try to protect her. And after her night with the king, Esther is deemed the fairest of all. We read in chapter 2, verse 17, the king loved Esther more than all the other of the virgins, and she won his favor and devotion, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gives, guess what, a great banquet for Esther. Actually, it's for all of his officials and ministers in Esther's honor. So, all this time, Uncle Mordecai, who's followed her, is sitting at the king's gate, but he does not reveal his relationship to the new queen. And at the gate one day, he overhears two of the court eunuchs plotting an assassination against the king, and he slips word to Esther. She reveals the plan to the king in Mordecai's name, and afterwards, both of the two perpetrators are hanged on the gallows, and it is recorded in the Royal Book of Chronicles in the presence of the king. Now, remember that detail because it comes important later on. Now the plot thickens. Enter the villain, Haman of the Agagite tribe, who, and the Agagite tribe, by the way, go way back to being enemies of the Jews. So King Xerxes promotes Haman, making him the grand vizier. He's sort of like a prime minister, second in command to the king. And on Haman's appointment, all the servants in the land bow down and revere Haman every time he walks by, as per the king's proclamation, except for Mordecai. When the servants ask Mordecai why he refuses to bow down, he explains that he's a Jew. And remember, we've said before, thank you. My husband is not here, so thank you. I mean, he's here, he's upstairs. But thank you, Chuck, for filling in as my advisor out there. Thank you very much. Okay, we don't want to update that right now, do we? Okay. So at any rate, Mordecai reveals he's a Jew, and the reason this is important is, in the polytheistic world, the Jews alone believe that there's only one true God. And as living that belief, they refuse to bow down to any human being. So we read Haman's reaction to this in chapter 3, verses 5 to 6. It says, "When Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down to him, he was infuriated. But he thought it beneath him to lay hands on Mordecai alone. So having been told who Mordecai's people were, Haman plotted to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom." So the Interpreter's Bible makes note here that this is not just a personal feud between Haman and Mordecai. It's really anti-Semitism, and it's more than just hatred of one Gentile for one Jew. To Haman, Mordecai is typical of all Jewish people, and his biggest sin is he does not conform. He does not conform to the king's law. And so Haman goes to the king and says, "There's certain people," this is what Haman says to the king, "there are certain people scattered and separated in the kingdom, in all the provinces, and their laws are different from those of all the other people. They do not keep the king's laws. So it's not appropriate for the king to tolerate them. If it pleases the king, let a decree be issued for their destruction, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who take charge of the king's business, so they may put it in the king's treasury." So basically, Haman is paying the king off to dispense with all the Jews. So once again, the king issues another edict. And from chapters 3, 13 to 15, we read, "Letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces, giving order to destroy, kill, and annihilate all Jews, young and old, women and children, and to plunder their goods." So now we're truly at the climax of the story. When Mordecai learns about this plot to annihilate his people, he, along with all the other Jews, goes into mourning. And next, he smuggles a copy of the edict to Esther with a note asking her to go to the king and try to get him to revoke this horrible decree. Esther sends a message back, reminding Mordecai that any man or woman who enters the king's courts without an invitation will be put to death, unless the king holds out, extends the golden scepter, indicating that a person can actually live. And the king hasn't asked for Esther in over a month. So she's thinking that she's maybe fallen out of favor. Remember, all those other virgins are still hanging around in the background, okay? So we read from chapter 4. When they told Mordecai what Esther had said, he sends a reply saying, "Do not think that in the king's palace you will escape any more than any of the other Jews. For if you keep silence at such a time as this, relief and different deliverance will arrive for the Jewish people from another quarter, but you and your family will perish. Who knows? Perhaps you have come to royal position for such a time as this." Perhaps you are here, right now, for such a time as this. And Esther answers Mordecai, asking him to have all the Jews in Susa hold a fast, not a feast, but a fast, for 3 days. And then she says, "After which I will go to the king, though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish." So, as planned, on the third day after the fast, Esther puts on her royal robes and goes, facing death, to the king. The text reads, "As soon as the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she won his favor immediately, and he held out to her the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther approached and touched the top of the scepter. The king said to her, 'What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given to you anything you want, even to the half of my kingdom.' Esther says, 'If it pleases the king, let the king and Haman come to a banquet tonight that I have prepared for the king.'" So the book of Esther is considered to be one of the most skillfully written books in the entire Bible. The author follows the Hebrew literary device in which events repeat themselves and sometimes mirror one another. Every listener to the story back in the day would have recognized these events, the repeated feast, the repeated edicts from the king, all building the rising tension to what's going to happen. And did you notice the irony of Vashti's refusal to come to the king when she's called, and Esther's appearing to the king without being called? There's another little twist of irony. Also note that the king offers Esther half of his kingdom, and she requests what? Only a feast, only a banquet, only a party. This modest request makes the king think that he's made a really wise choice in having Esther as his queen. And so the king, Esther, and Haman dine together at the feast, and at the end of the feast, once again, the king says to Esther, "Is there anything else you would like? I will give you half of my kingdom." And she requests, guess what? Yet another feast, yet another banquet. So, as he leaves, Haman is really pleased with himself. He thinks that he has received great favor from the queen. However, on the way home, he runs into Mordecai, who is sitting at the palace gate and who once again refuses to bow to him. Now Haman goes home and tells his wife and friends gathered around about the disrespect of Mordecai, recounting to them all the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, all the honors he has received, and how King Xerxes has advanced him above all the other official ministers. He is not lacking in ego. Are we getting that impression? And he says, "Queen Esther, let no one but myself come before the king to the banquet that she prepared. Tomorrow I'm also invited to dine with her and the king. Yet all this does me no good as long as I see the Jew Mordecai sitting there at the king's gate and not bowing to me." So Haman's wife suggests that he build a gallows on which to hang Mordecai, which Haman thinks is a good idea. He does it immediately with the help of his 10 sons. That night, however, experiencing insomnia, the king calls for his royal ministers to come read to him from the Royal Book of Chronicles. And remember, what's in the Royal Book of Chronicles, when they get to that part about Mordecai reporting the assassination and saving the king's life, the king realizes that he hasn't done anything to honor Mordecai back, that he's neglected to honor him. So the king says, where's Haman? Now, it just happened that Haman was outside in the outer court waiting to speak to the king about Mordecai's execution, and the king calls him in. The king says to Haman, what shall be done for the man to whom the king wishes to honor? Now, of course, guess who Haman thinks the king is talking about? Himself. That's exactly right. So of course Haman is all excited and he says, oh my goodness, I think the man deserves great honor. I think he deserves royal robes which the king himself has worn. I think he deserves a horse that the king has ridden, and I think even the horse should have a royal crown on his head. And the king says, great, great. Let the robes and the horse be handed over to the most noble officials. Let them robe him as you describe. Let them conduct him through horseback, through the open square of the city, so all can pay homage. Now, Haman at this point is practically salivating at the opportunity to have all of this, you know, laud and glory. And then the king says to him, quickly, don't just stand there. Take the robes and the horse, as you have said, and go to the Jew Mordecai, who sits at the king's gate, and make sure he is so robed. Leave nothing out that you have mentioned. So, didn't quite go according to Haman's plan, did it? So once again, Haman returns home, humiliated again. And that night, at the planned feast, as they are drinking wine, the king asks Esther what her petition is, and again offers her half of the kingdom. Then Queen Esther finally reveals her identity and says, if I have won your favor, O king, and if it please you, my only request is to let my life be. That is my petition, along with the lives of my people. That is my only request. For we have been sold, I and my people, soon to be destroyed, killed, and annihilated. And outraged, the king asked the identity of this vile man who's responsible. And when Esther reveals Haman as the enemy, the king has Haman hanged on the gallows at Haman's own house, the gallows that he has built, and he makes Mordecai prime minister. And the very first edict that Mordecai and Esther grant, with the king's permission, of course, is that the Jews all throughout the Persian Empire have the right to defend themselves against those who might ever try to harm them in the future. So the Jews then successfully defeat their enemies throughout all the provinces, and Esther and Mordecai declare a day of feasting, which is celebrated today as the Jewish festival of Purim. So, it's an entertaining little story, and trust me, I've only given you the cliff notes, okay? If you like to read it, it's the whole chapter of Esther in the Old Testament. But the point is, even though God is not specifically mentioned in the story, Bible scholar Ed Townley says it's a beautiful story about holding to spiritual principles in the face of all sorts of worldly pressures and appearances. And I think we can all see divine order unfolding in every single little twist and turn of the story. Now, most of you know, in Unity, we look at each character, place, and event in the Bible, trying to look at it and ask ourselves, what can I learn about this, about my own spiritual growth? How can I see myself in the story? And maybe we can begin to answer that about this story by just looking quickly at the main characters. First of all, the king. History reveals that there actually was a king, Xerxes I, and he did rule the Persian Empire about the time the story is set. So he is historically accurate. But metaphysically, according to the Metaphysical Bible Dictionary, the king in the story, Xerxes, represents, now get this, the will puffed up by its conquests and dominated by ambition. And it's the function of the will to rule, and when a man is more ambitious than wise, then he often makes a spectacle of himself. Did that sound like the king? All through the story, remember, he's not the sharpest knife in the drawer, is he? I mean, he's always getting advice from all of his all of his ministers, and sometimes it's not very good advice, and he sort of comes across as a buffoon. Some of his edicts are foolish, and some are downright unreasonable and really harmful. So Esther represents the dissolving power of spiritual love, and spiritual love is always an antidote for a dictatorial will. And when we can hold that consciousness of divine love in the inner court of our being, our thoughts and actions are always based on harmonizing love, and it permeates everything and everyone around us. Unselfish love is also fearless. There's no fear in love. And that's how Esther has the courage to go to the king without an invitation. The Metaphysical Bible Dictionary says, understanding of divine law is the one necessary thing in all permanent unions. The golden scepter, do you wonder what that represents? Anybody want to guess? Remember, he has to extend it to Esther. It represents understanding. It's a symbol of understanding. And Esther touching the very top of it symbolizes the highest type of understanding. In other words, spiritual understanding. In other words, when we know the truth, when we know the truth that we are all one and we know that there is no separation, that's when we are united in spirit with everyone on earth. Mordecai's name in Hebrew means little man and contrition, symbolizing that humility always marks a great person and is necessary in turning away from error to truth. Metaphysically, he symbolizes spiritual power, working with each one of us to form our own spirit, to claim our own spiritual identity. And hapless Haman, what does he represent? Well, he represents the activity of what Charles Fillmore calls the carnal human. He was all ego, wasn't he? It was all about him and his own glory. And carnal consciousness can be in opposition to the spiritual. Carnal consciousness is always jealous for power and strives to eliminate all that stands in its way. And so the king, through most of the story, represents sense consciousness, and the Jews, Mordecai, and especially Esther, symbolize spiritual consciousness. Elizabeth Sand Turner says, this story depicts the conflict between the higher and baser qualities of our minds, showing that the spiritual always overcomes, always. And at that pivotal moment when Esther has to make that choice between a selfish decision to save her own life and a selfless action to save her people, that is a choice that we have to make every day of our lives. Are we going to live from our spiritual selves? Or are we going to get caught all caught up in human consciousness? And the point is that no matter what is facing us, no matter what seems to be looming large on the outer, when we can turn our pivotal souls from the fear and the challenge to the Christ of our being, and that spiritual love triumphs, we always have the courage, always, to do everything that is needed to be done by us. For it is in such times as this that we are on this earth. So let's pray about that. As we prepare for our time of prayer and meditation, let's affirm the great truth that makes all things possible, the great truth about the divine. There is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life. God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is. Together, there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life. God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is.